All right. Hello, everyone. This is a very special pre-show to CTF Radio. I have ambushed actually several people here. So Jan, you're here, but don't say your catchphrase. I want you to save that for later. So say something else to say hi to everyone.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Wow, that took you a long time to think of something to even say to people.
When you're a one-trick pony, it's hard to come up with a second trick.
Well, it's like a catchphrase. Once you have your catchphrase, it's hard to be known without it.
Exactly.
So we have two guests here. I will introduce what they're doing here. One of them knows and one of them doesn't really know. So Swarty is here and my mom is here. So just briefly say hi, wave to the camera, and then I'll explain why you're here.
Hi, I'm Swarty.
Hi, I'm Carlene Adam's mom.
Okay, so they are here. Swarty helped me out with a very secret project. Oh, yeah, I'm just going to dive right in and maybe he can talk about it. Actually, maybe first mom will talk about it, even though she doesn't know what she's talking about yet. And then Swarty will talk about it. So I think this is going to come through. I hope so. I wanted to test this beforehand, but I had to run to this recording. But let's see if we can all hear this. Bam.
Wow.
That slaps.
Wow, that's awesome.
Got a great beat.
Nice. Yeah. So, I don't know if my mom remembers, but she wrote lyrics to... You do? Okay, yeah. So, she wrote lyrics
to... That was
to...
me?
Well, you wrote the lyrics.
That was our first collab.
And you
Very
didn't even know
nice.
It.
Nice. I didn't even know it.
Surprise collaboration. So, my mom
this
wrote lyrics
super
like...
super legit.
2 years ago or 3 years ago, and I had just been, I don't know, like burnt out from doing all the CTF Radio stuff, and I couldn't think of doing another production thing like on top of that. And then I finally, like a month ago, was like, you know, Swarty is such an incredible artist. Like, I honestly, I was a little bit worried about insulting Swarty of like, just do this like dinky, you know, our little tiny podcast that gets hundreds of listeners, do this thing. But I was like, man, it'd be such a cool thing to do. And I know he's great. So that's when I reached out to him to see if he'd be interested in it. So you want to talk about it a little bit, Swarty? And then there's also an outro too. So we have that's the banger intro. And then we have a cool outro.
Yeah, I feel like we buried the lead just a little bit because, you wrote. Quite a bit more lyrics than just CTF Radio. That's all you need to know. And yeah, many of those made it into the outro too. But yeah, this was kind of a surprise. I was in Portugal on an artist residency and got a call from Adam. I'm familiar with the podcast, but had maybe seen a total of like one episode. And so we had a conversation about just kind of like an exploratory chat about what kind of sound, what kind of direction. And we sort of had boiled things down to a dubstep tempo and rhythm, but with sort of an 8-bit video game aesthetic. That falls somewhere inside my wheelhouse, or at least adjacent to it. And yeah, didn't get a chance to start working until I was back in the States, which I am now. And yeah, a couple weeks later, there's an intro and an outro. Are we going to listen to the outro as well, or did you want to hold off on it?
Adam, you're muted.
We lost you, Adam.
Sorry, I was pausing or muting for the baby. Yeah, we can we'll play it in a second. I want to, as you can maybe tell in Jan's background, if people are watching on YouTube, you can see Jan is a collector of old like box video games. So there's like Prince of Persia. One's a dungeon keeper that I can see, but it's hard for us. You'll see on the YouTube video, there's more of a frame. I can only see a little frame here, but it's, what is it? Three full shelves, four full shelves.
Yeah.
So that's why when you,
four shelves of boxes. And then on this side, and there's console stuff. It's so my,
when you said like 8-bit, like, you know, retro kind of sound, I was like, oh yeah, that's very Tech. Much in our wheelhouse.
Yeah, right. there's a tiny extra nugget of BTS as well, which is that about 6 months ago, I did some sort of like sound font finding and some sample hunting for a friend of mine who was directing a theater performance, like a play that she'd written called Rats versus Roaches. And there's this there's this scene where the roaches are going to get into the microwave to charge themselves up so that they can go extra strong into battle. And they were looking for something on the spectrum of like dubstep to basically like Zion Matrix Bloodwave techno. Yep. And so the stuff that ended up in that play ended up being more techno, more Bloodrave, and the stuff that was left over, a lot of that landed in your theme song.
That's so cool. So what do you think, Jan?
It's awesome. It feels like we're a legit podcast finally, because it's always like, all right, well, we have our outro, the intro, I mean, it's all like, you know, you don't have the wacky like YouTube things and the whatever. Now we're getting there.
I'm not sure. Well, we'll have some of that Sorting Out Plans. Mom, what did you think of the intro?
I liked it a lot. And I think what Sorty said is true. It's got a definite, I mean, I was never a video gamer or whatever Jan has behind him. But I've heard you guys play and it fits right in there.
Also, that's not true. You played Atari growing up, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
you were a Ponger.
That's not quite the same as... Yeah, very, very early stage.
But nowadays, none of this stuff gets played. It's here for me to look at and remember. Right. There's and remember. No time.
Right.
There's no right. time.
No time? You don't even have machines great. To play it. What are you talking about?
I have machines.
Okay.
There's no time.
I mean, that's, I guess, true. But that's you're not playing these discs. You don't have a floppy drive that you're plugging these things into.
Jan's saying, yes, I do.
All right. Show me that next time I'm at your house, and I would love to hear that. All right.
For real. I'll show you.
Should we hear the outro?
Yeah.
All right. So pretend that I've done the outro, although it's kind of the idea. I'll show you in the produced version, but the idea is we'll kind of fade it in, and when the beat drops in the beginning is when I stop talking, and then the rest of it takes over. It's a little longer, but it's definitely worth a listen, and I think it'll be a good
one. Feel free to fade it out whenever you're ready.
Yeah, we'll see.
Easter eggs. It's all about the hack. Python. Chaos. Nights of sleep never getting back. Noob or elite. Make your best attack. Because it's all for the glory of capturing that flag.
Adam, we lost you again.
Fuck. What do you think? Thoughts? Sorry. I'm very bad at this, apparently.
I like it.
It's a good chill out at that. It makes me think of This American Life always has some sort of a little music at the end as the outro play. I wonder, should we do a voiceover over that? There's voices in it, so probably not.
The idea was like we speak and then like you can go see it in the finished versions, but like we speak and then or I'm doing the outro and then as soon as I stop is when the beat drops right in the beginning. There's like 15, it's like 12, 15 seconds in there where it'll kind of fade in. That'll drop and then
nice.
We'll put up like the logo or something. Swordy was trying to get me to become an influencer and put the videos that they could click on and stuff while the rest of it plays.
We should just be standing as still as possible, like in the Naked Gun.
It's a great idea. There's kind of two moments where I could see dropping out vocals too. So you could sort of say your last words and then the beat drops and keep that fairly low, like kind of medium volume while you do credits. I mean, I don't know if there are credits, but if you wanted to thank a producer and thank your music guy and then, you know, you'd have time before the actual vocals come in.
That's great. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. But yes, I told you I was going to do that.
Yeah, could be one way to handle it. But anyway, there's lots to work with there. You guys have more than you need, I'm sure.
It's awesome. This is kind of the last thing I was expecting today.
It's a double ambush. I had to lie to my mom to get her on. We are going to do our normal episode after this, but this will live like as a bumper right in the beginning. But I wanted to surprise you with this.
I also think it adds a lot more, as I've been listening to podcasts, everybody has the intro and everybody has the outro. And they all talk about who produced it and who else is involved in it and did all those things. So I think it adds another layer of professionalism to you guys.
Yeah, the only thing you're missing now is your big money sponsor music ad break.
I was thinking of that, like the fade out, the from the outro, like reversing it for bumpers on ads. But there's a big problem there, Swordy. We don't have any ads.
We don't have any sponsors.
So once we have those big sponsors that wants to dump a lot of money on us, people want to talk to the Capture the Flag community. You know, we're the people that have those hundreds of ears. So,
well, step one is unnecessarily hype music to introduce and end your podcast.
100%. That was actually, like Jan mentioned, This American Life. We'll just get, 10% of their listeners and we'll be perfectly fine.
Totally. You guys are going to be a Radiotopia pod before you know it, or PRX.
Amazing.
Whatever it is.
Exactly.
One day we'll even know what those things are.
Swordy, you want to... One of the reasons why I reach out to you is I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel you kind of have a lot of the DIY hacker kind of aesthetic and mindset to when you're producing and creating music. Jan actually may remember... One of the things I did when we were hosting DEF CON CTF finals in 2021 was play your Secret Sky recording on giant monitors for the teams. And several people would be stopped and watch that because it was so freaking cool. I don't know. Can you talk about that a little bit?
For sure. Yeah. So my history is that I was in a band for a long time and we had all of the pieces that come with, sort of traditional music business, like managers and agents and record labels and PR stuff. And so when that all kind of wound down for me, I was very intentional about not hiring or sort of doing any business collaborations at all anymore because it just felt super unnecessary. And also, I think maybe it's a little better for me, just my personality, to have only myself to blame when things go horribly wrong. That definitely spiraled into a little bit of the community building too. Something I've had going for a really long time is a pretty active email group. The thesis statement is just, whatever you're working on, garden, bowling, music, cooking, doesn't matter. Just we're all kind of doing the same thing, trying to push a little further on something. And that's the type of group that I sort of stay close with and share progress with. Certainly that's been a very open source mindset. No gatekeeping, and I share lots of my works in progress with people, and I don't know if there's an overlap there, but it feels connected.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what, hacking is knowledge is what we usually always say. And so the way that, information wants to be free and needs to get out is very much part of the hacker ethos. So I definitely see a lot of overlap there, which is super awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Well, all right. Do you have anything to plug for our, vast array of audiences? And now that they've heard your dope podcast music?
I think since basically everyone listening will have never heard my name before, search Swordy on YouTube and check out my Secret Sky set. That's a 30-minute performance that I did for an online music festival, or you can see a short film that I animated called Compact Objects. I'm proud of both of those things. So they're a good start.
Super sweet. Yeah. I really, really enjoy that. Cool. Mom, do you have final things you want to say to the people?
I am very honored to be a part of your podcast in the lyrics. I think that's great.
Long time listener, totally, first time guest.
Yeah, that's what I told Swarty when I saw him. Yes, I listen to you guys, every one of your sets. I don't understand 95% of what you say, but I love seeing your faces and hearing your voices. So I do. Thank you. That was really, you touched my heart, my love. So
well, you're
that
welcome.
Was really nice. Thank you.
I frequently get texts or calls like, what is fuzzing?
I just said that. No, I just said that last time. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm trying to learn. I may not be in the business, but, you know, can always learn something. So, yeah, right. That's been great. Thank you.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you to Swarty and my mom, Carlene. We really appreciate that. And we're going to pause here and redo it in a second. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the normal segment of CTF Radio that you came here because you know and love everything CTF. The topic today, we're going to be, now that we've interviewed all seven of the AICC teams for over an hour and a half each, it was a lot of talking. Now we're going to kind of go through and think about our thoughts on the competition, because we're sitting here right now. It's Wednesday, August 6th, and the winners are going to be announced Friday, August 8th. So we're in this very tight window here where before we know what the results are. So as usual, I am Adam D, and I have, as always, my co-host, Jan. Jan, say the thing.
Hello, hackers.
I'm sure we'll get better at knowing that, and you will stop talking after you say your catchphrase.
Yeah, that was awesome. I think it flowed, other than me trying to keep speaking, it flowed super well.
Yeah, it's like, it is a crazy earworm. Like, Swarty did a really, really good job. Like, since I've got this copy, I've been, like, singing this in my head.
Yeah, it's very cool.
All right, so now, AICC, Jan, we've talked to seven teams. We've done over 10 hours of podcasting in the last month, absolutely shattering any previous CTF Radio episode record for episodes recorded. How are you feeling about that? Let's talk about the AICC competition first in general. So did you come away with any new insights or thoughts about the competition itself from talking with the teams?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to be a kind of stuck in your own bubble with these things. And for me, of course, the AICC is like the successor competition in some sense to the Cyber Grand Challenge
Yes, as you keep mentioning. And were you involved in the Cyber Grand Challenge at all?
Actually, I was a little bit. Yeah.
What?
So I know it's shocking, but I was the captain of Team Shellfish in the Cyber Grand Challenge, right? And we, you know, I made a really cool CRS, blah, 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 blah. And with the AICC, my involvement is very different, right? We are advisors to the students that are doing the true work of the AICC. And we get pulled in every once in a while. But for the most part, we're in these advisory roles. And in an advisory role, it's very easy to kind of lose the technical details a little bit, right? We were able to catch up on our own technical details, you know, in these final pushes where we were dragged in and went, you know, hands on and everything. But it's very easy to kind of, not having lived it full time for the duration of the competition. Unlike the CGC, it's very easy to say, yeah, but in the CGC, we did in the CGC. And it's very interesting talking to all the teams. You start realizing, oh, shit, you know, it's just the style of this competition is very interestingly different. We can talk about the differences between AIC and CGC, of course, but just kind of getting a truer feel of what everyone went through.
I think because it helps you understand the shape of the competition, right? The competition itself has shape and structure, and that almost forces the teams to fit into there. I think what was one of my big takeaways about the competition itself is that I thought the shape of the competition was going to be tighter. Like, I thought it would have forced teams into a smallish bubble of design and those type of things.
Which is what happened with the Cyber Grand Challenge.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And do you think that was do you actually think that was the competition design or the technical state of automated cyber reasoning systems at the time?
It's an interesting question. I think it was probably, I mean, this is kind of a cop-out answer, but it's a combination of the two. So in the Cyber Grand Challenge, you had a very narrowly defined operating system environment, right? Where you had seven system calls. There wasn't persistence. There wasn't a file system. There was, you know, just a very basic input-output and memory management. And this is where, you know, the programs existed in that space, which empowered certain techniques that with the AICC's, I mean, abandonment is a bad word, but the AICC moved on past that. The AICC had real software, real complex things. So it opened up the design space a bit. But having this constraint made certain technologies much more applicable. I think a good example.
Maybe overly applicable, because then they couldn't be applied in the real world.
Yes, exactly. I think a good example is symbolic execution, right? Uh-huh. Which I always
feel. Isn't that what you built your career on?
Exactly. I always feel a little awkward saying, because it is, you know, a huge chunk of my research in grad school and a huge chunk of, you know, Anger's early capabilities. And it's extremely effective. It's this for those that don't know, a way of modeling data mutations and checks on data that allow you to solve these complex equations that are unsolvable in the general that are not solvable efficiently in the general case, but in kind of the specifics, you can often get away with it. And you build up these equations, you solve them, and then you can, using the solutions of these equations, trigger specific program functionality. And we use this to huge effect in two places. In the Cyber Grand Challenge, because these programs had extremely structured or extremely well understood input and output interfaces, and in CTFs for the same reason. A typical CTF reversing takes some input or whatever and says correct, wrong, or whatever. And during the development of the Cyber Grand Challenge, the development of the mechanical fish, our entry in the Cyber Grand Challenge, we created such a powerful symbolic execution capability that we were just sniping out reverse engineering challenges just as a matter of course. Like, there would be a CTF that would come out, especially before we open sourced Anger and the world didn't know. Right. There'd be a CTF that comes out and, you know, you have your standard at the time, like five vulnerables, five reversings, five this, and we just do boom, 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 boom. All the reversings gone. Right. And and even afterwards, when the world did know about Anger and tried to, there was this interesting shift in the CTF community where reversing challenge authors would sit down and say, can Anger just solve my challenge, and then adapt until it couldn't. We were better at using Anger than the authors of most challenges.
Right.
Typically, when they'd break the Anger in the challenge, it was an easy tweak for us. But in the real world, the input output specifications are much more complicated. There's, you know, not just networking and so on. You can get around that, although automatically getting around that is very tough. You know, what the program does, persistence, all of these like multi-process communications, tons of complex stuff that's extremely hard to model in the emulator that you have to run programs in for Symbolic.
Right. I think the way, for people who aren't familiar with this, the way I usually try to think about it is, like you said, essentially at the core, symbolic execution is kind of following a program path you can think about and reasoning about what path it would take, but that the input is essentially an unknown. So is what I think about. And so as it goes, it's building constraints on what that unknown can be and says, well, this path means that these bytes have to be less than 10. So I'm going to keep that constraint, and it kind of builds up these constraints. The key problem is, as these unknowns, I think like the key difference between CGC, the unknowns were very well specified, whereas in real world software, these unknowns are incredibly complex. You have a program receives, you know, when I think about Giovanni has this great diagram that I really like about how to think about like vulnerability analysis against an application, right? So it's all about where it can get input from. So if you think about an application, what are all the different ways it can get input, right? It's standard input, it's standard output, it's files on the file system, it's network requests. There's so many places that it can get input from that this uncertainty can come in, and without explicitly modeling that, and even in things as simple as like you said, 7 system calls, Linux has what, over 300 system calls. When your symbolic execution engine sees the system call, it has to understand, how does this affect the formulas that I've created, and how does this constrain the unknown, or does it add new unknowns that then I need to track and reason about as I go forward? So there's just a explosion in complexity and kind of unknowns that makes symbolic execution not as tractable on real world stuff in certain cases.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's you mentioned the two reasons. It's that environment modeling. The other reason I mentioned, like the whole like equation, blah blah blah. People hyper focus on that equation thing because it's an algorithmic challenge, and you know, it's an NP complete SAT solving, blah 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 blah. I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but it's so much less relevant than the environmental modeling problem.
And the funny thing is, it's the exact same problem in static analysis, right? If you're trying to analyze a program statically, look for vulnerabilities, you have to reason about where it interacts with the environment and then create a model of how that interaction like messes with or changes your interpretation of the program. And if you don't have a good model of that, then you'll find too many bugs that there's not enough that exist, or you'll miss bugs because you'll miss data dependencies and other types of behavior.
Exactly. And this actually is also very relevant to the Cybergrand challenge, because when we created Anger, we envisioned this single platform that does both static analysis and symbolic execution, right? And there's these philosophical arguments that one equals the other, but they're very different from an implementation perspective, right? So our environmental models informed both things. And so we were able to take those 7 system calls, model them perfectly, and use that both for vulnerability discovery and symbolic execution, and for program repair in static analysis. And then when you step out into the real world and you say, okay, well, now let's try Nginx, it's a shit show.
The other crazy thing that this makes me think about, I wonder, you know, I guess maybe we're getting a little deep in the weeds here, but do you think there's an analogy to be made, especially when you said step out into the real world? The first thing I think of is self-driving cars, right? And the original, or one of the grand challenges on self-driving cars, right? Very constrained environment, like they failed completely on that. And even over the years, as those systems got better, it was still in constrained environment. And it wasn't until 15 plus years later where you started seeing them deployed in real world scenarios. And then, of course, you saw them fail in interesting ways in these real world scenarios. Do you think that we're just like, there's some breakthroughs that we're missing to get there, or?
No, I think it's subtly different. I think when you say self-driving cars, that is an umbrella that includes an enormous amount of approaches and technologies. And I don't know a ton about this area, but I would bet that some of the early ideas in self-driving cars just dead-ended. But the whole field still push forward because, hey, now we know not to do that. I think we could be, if Fish and I have a lot of these discussions about symbolic execution versus fuzzing, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we could be in a world where, hey, a couple of, like you said, fundamental, pieces of progress or whatever, maybe using LLMs to describe the effects of these syscalls, for example, and suddenly symbolic execution becomes viable. That's possible. I think what is more likely and what is, I think, happening is instead the umbrella of cyber autonomy, the idea that, you know, a mechanical fish, an artificial, a robo duck, a buttercup, a lacrosse, or whatever, can push the field forward and autonomously analyze software, that I think is much more realistic and is happening.
So that's great. So I think that's a really good analogy. And I think the way I'd probably sum that up is like without knowing this field, which I think definitely makes sense, right? With like modern machine learning algorithms are very different now than they were 15 years ago. So the designs of these systems are fundamentally different. And they use lots of different machine learning AI algorithms all over the place, right, to like be able to plot courses and detect things. And there's LIDARs and all this stuff. But part of that, there's probably some similarities, but then other designs that fell by the wayside. And part of like science and engineering that pushes us forward is you have a current state of the art, and then that gives you something to beat with some other technique, right? So maybe the state of the art, like you said, is, well, you get that 5% better and 5% better, but then it's 4% better and 2% better and 1% better. And it plateaus, but a new technique comes along that's now 10% better. But if you didn't have the other thing to compare it against, you may not be able to get that breakthrough.
Yeah. And then there's also these evergreen technologies that are stumbled into by accident almost. I think a good example from the Cyber Grand Challenge is fuzzing. Right? It turned out everyone had some analog of a fuzzing system or a fuzzing engine and a symbolic execution engine. They work together. That was the common design of the vulnerability detection part of the Cyber Grand Challenge. Instead of driving cars, it's LIDAR. And so it's like, well, even that's arguable, right? But, you know, I think fuzzing is the LIDAR of cyber autonomy.
Right, yeah. That's great. And then, and just like, I mean, man, I think we're getting pretty into it. But once it's shown to be useful in there, I'm sure there was a lot of other research that went into driving down the cost of LIDAR arrays and making them more reliable. Yeah. Just like fuzzing saw, as soon as people realized, oh, wow, this is like a real thing that is really like usable. Can we, like, how do we make it faster? How do we make it better? How do we not waste time? How do we do better instrumentation? How do we, like, other types of optimization algorithms? How do we optimize seed selection, right? There was so much work put on making fuzzing more effective.
And again, just the way science works, the majority of that work is going to be dead ends and wasted in some sense, you know, in terms of explicit results effort, but it all informs the field. And then the next big thing comes along, and it turns out what I think we'll end up seeing, and we, you know, like you said, we just keep getting deeper and deeper into the weeds. What we'll end up seeing is that fuzzing is awesome as a base, but all of this like super hyper specialization, let's think really carefully about seed selection, that's not the fundamental. The fundamental advancement is fuzzing, and then an LLM feeds you seeds, an LLM does you some mutation, like these sort of much more broad.
Or what I see is even, you know, because I'm trying to think about crossing the cyber reasoning systems from the current AICC platform to real world usage and deployment, mm-hmm. is the harnessing problem. Like, mm-hmm. to even apply these techniques in the first place for the AICC, you need harnesses that are written in OSS fuzz compatible formats, which just companies and software doesn't have. So like, that's a step that I can definitely see LLMs being useful for doing this, but you need that in order to even apply everything else. And so, yeah, I think that's really cool. Okay, so, yeah, go ahead.
By necessity, having a shape of a competition implies that there is a bunch of stuff outside of that shape.
Yes.
So in the
yes.
Cyber Grand Challenge, that was the environment. And that proved to be a big impediment. So out of the Cyber Grand Challenge, I wouldn't say no one applied it to the real world. I think For All Secure, for example, is who won the Cyber Grand Challenge, is an excellent example of a company that went on to apply their techniques to the real world. but it was a big, you know, complicated effort to do so. In the AICC, I think that step is smaller. But it still remains, right? Like you said, and you know, harnessing was explicitly out of scope.
Yeah, and I think exactly. And I think the super interesting thing that you said about the shape of the competition defines that usefulness gap. I think you can even see that in the evolution of the design of the AICC competition itself and the shape of the competition by how they change things from quals to finals, right? And like they said, okay, you know, and it's kind of, on one hand, it's fun. I would love to talk to, you know, people if they can help talk to us about the real world, you know, the insights of why they did these things. We can only guess from the outside. But, you know, it on the one hand, changing the competition from just one aspect, right? How much LLM usage can you use, from $100 to, what is it, $10,000 or whatever the larger budgets are, $5,000?
75 overall.
Yeah, 75,000 overall. Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. And that's just GPT.
Yeah, that's credits.
Don't quote me on this. I just keep forgetting.
So this is the problem. We weren't super involved, so we had to act like the professors.
Well, we had to catch up.
Sure. I'm saying we weren't as in the weeds for two years.
Yeah, it wasn't
like
2 years of our lives.
But the budgets, about these numbers, I think, significantly increased. So on the one hand, you'd be like, well, why did we run this quals that selected for teams that could only do the $100 credits? But on the other hand, you think, well, shouldn't this competition show where we could go? Like, as $100 in credits today is not going to be the same in 2 or 3 years from now. So if we're building this with an eye to the future of systems that can be deployable, let's see what they can do with this AI stuff and how that can shape the design of these systems and how well that impacts their performance. And I think it's definitely a reasonable thing to do, and was super interesting seeing them tweak that to change the shape of the game to the design of the systems.
It's in some sense an argument could be made for, I'm sure there are practical limitations on how much credits they can grant people, grant the teams for the competition, but there's an argument to be made for what can you do with unlimited LLM credits, and unlimited CPU power. Right, because then realistically, given unlimited CPU power, we would have a system that looked much like what artificial looked like, because it had an enormous amount of CPU. And given unlimited amount of LLM credits, we probably would have pushed that farther, but maybe double, I would guess, but not like really unlimited. But I was talking to someone actually in the middle of all of our, you know, crazy filming of the podcast episodes, and I had this cool like presentation all about artificial end-to-end, and I mentioned like, yeah, I mean, you know, you don't want to spend like, you know, $75,000 to analyze just one target. And someone says, why not? If that one target,
what's the target? Exactly.
Yeah, maybe not, you know, my toy computer science homework dot eeks whatever, but if the target is, you know, I don't know.
Think about in the context of AICC. Kernel. Well, for sure, you know, but I was thinking even open source software that's used by anyone, like Log4j wasn't open source, but you could think about like OpenSSL, right? Like Heartbleed. There was a giant vulnerability in OpenSSL that let people read memory and extract keys and everything. And like that would be worth a lot of millions of dollars to fix something like that in infrastructure that we all use.
To avoid the chaos. I mean, in some sense, maybe the chaos is unavoidable, but like to find it before it gets exploited, this sort of stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's possible that I could see an economic argument being made for, you know, how much do you need? Do you need, you know, $1 million in credit? For $1 million, can you find all the bugs? If you don't
exactly
know yet,
what I was,
right?
I was thinking,
you know,
about the cyber
systems are just born.
It's exactly the assurance problem in cybersecurity that I talk about in my class. It's that you can't, like, your $1 million example is great. Let's say you hired a pen testing company to pen test your systems, your software for $1 million. Is it secure? What if you paid $100,000, like $500,000 for that pen test? Is it half as secure? Right? Like, you know, quantifying how much you can get out of that, I think is a super interesting field of
And in some sense, like now we will have next week 7 open source cyber reasoning systems. Out of those, some subset will actually be runnable. Running these things, of course, as we know from experience, is extremely difficult. But if you have all of these and you start tweaking, like this mm-hmm. is a science paper, right? We measure and we make hypotheses and we show we have 2 axes. We have a 3D graph, right? How much compute, how much LLM, and how many bugs you find. And we show, okay, well, hey, and how many bugs, like, compared to how many bugs there are that you know of. Because we have historical data, because now we can analyze all of our assessments. We have all this historical data. We know that these bugs were found. How many of them can we find? Right. And now, I mean, especially another thought on another phenomenon of these automated systems, which is kind of interesting.
Well, it is interesting. Okay, self-evaluated interesting thought by Zardes. We should get some Zardes's interesting thought. Go ahead.
Boom.
Wait, maybe this is what you need to hear.
I'm a fan of Zardes.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Okay, this isn't my observation originally, but someone observed that all of these automated systems, the first thing they do, automated bug finding systems, is make themselves irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Because you have a fuzzer, like let's say AFL came on the scene back in 2013 or whatever. It started getting applied to everything, and everything it got applied to, it found a ton of bugs. And it found the types of bugs that, you know, a naive coverage guided fuzzing approach can find, and found all of these bugs, and then it stopped finding bugs as easily, right? Uh-huh. Now, there's this logarithmic thing where you hit this asymptote and you're like, well, you know, now we need a new approach. That's going to happen with these techniques as well, right? So what we're going to see, and we're seeing right now, so, you know, one cool development since we talked to Shellfish is parts of the like Shellfish is full of scientists, right? So this all this measurement stuff is exactly what the next
step
is.
So they claim.
So that, yeah, exactly. Self-reported. Self-reported scientists. So, you know, right now, parts of artificial are running, being evaluated in different scenarios, and we're finding old days in real-world software that are now going to start getting, you know, which is super cool because
I don't know if
so
you saw
hard.
This, but frequent guest Tyler from Theory posted that they're having the problem of reporting all of the the ODAs that they're finding because yeah. like the reporting yeah. part is a problem and a bottleneck.
But what's going to happen, there will be this crazy flurry. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a risk to the technology. Crazy flurry of bugs found, and then those will be reported, and then let's say we tear Nginx apart and we have this blah, 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 tons of bugs in Nginx found by AICC systems. Someone gets very excited. They take RoboDuck or they take artificial and they run Nginx through it and it doesn't find any bugs. Right. Why? Because it's already found the bugs.
Yeah.
The bugs that it's going to find. And then people start getting kind of dehyped from the technology, which can be kind of a bummer. Right. And this happened, I think, kind of in the early days of symbolic execution, because there are real-world programs that happen to fit into the nice input-output. But, you know, you have papers like Mayhem, Veritasing. They found the bugs in those, and then now what? Right?
Yeah.
And there are other problems, but yeah.
That's great. Okay, so now we talked about the shape of the competition. So talk to me about what struck you on your overall impressions of the teams. Like talking to the teams, their technical direction. So less about the shape of the systems and more about the shape of the teams, let's say.
Dude, this is a crazy thing.
You don't remember any of the episodes. Me either.
No. Yeah. So I'm a very... Like, I can get caught in these kind of, this is my team, everyone else is the enemy sort of things. I think it's common in like, you know, any sort of team sports with team, competition-based things. And with the Cyber Grand Challenge, there wasn't a venue for this sort of, you know, even indirect inter-team communication that this season of the podcast has provided. And so it was very easy... Up until the end, and then we started kind of hanging out more after the competition started to see everyone as the enemy, right? And I think, you know, part of it is I had that experience after the Cyber Grand Challenge where suddenly the enemy that's mayhem, now we're friends and we're like, oh, do you remember we were in the trenches together? It's like, sure, we were in opposite sides of the battlefield in the trenches, but we were both in the trenches. The same sort of so that experience kind of informed, you know, my view of the AICC this time. I was like, oh yeah, these guys are also cool and they're doing their own thing, and they might, you know, cost us $4 million because they'll beat us out, but yep, you know, they're super cool. And then we went and interviewed and talked to all these people, and you see the commonality of everyone is just super excited about this tech,
right?
Open source, awesome. You know, all of this, that LLM. So everyone came in as, for the most part, hackery people,
mm-hmm,
with either a heavy background in program analysis or a heavy background in AI. And they just kind of adopted the ethos. And you know, I think if you took all of the teams and you literally re-randomized them and put it like that, maybe some of the technical approaches would change, et cetera, right? But I think everyone would find common ground.
Yeah, I think there's
definitely, that was the, there's two big takeaways for me. One was just how great it was talking to these people. Like, I think it was definitely showed you that there is a community around these tools. It's something that, like, what part of the reason why I love being in academia is being able to go to conferences and talk to like-minded, you know, my peers and colleagues in, you know, professors, PhD students. Like, these are people that love solving problems, love cybersecurity, love, you know, being in this stuff. So talking to them about it, I felt a very similar vibe where it's like, yeah, we're all like trying to do cool stuff. The second thing, I was shocked by the diversity of design of the systems, like truly shocked. I think, like you said, it was probably a failure on my part of imagination, or I just had, you know, thought people, well, they'll do more CGC style program analysis with AI. And there'll be people that do mostly AI, like fully AI stuff with program analysis. But seeing the wide variety, like, I cannot wait to count up the parens in LaCrosse's CRS. Like, having a freaking, I say old school, but like, you know, the agent-based AI systems and work, you know, that, like, especially
traditional
written in
AI
list,
brought into the future.
Traditional AI brought in. To see how does that fit into this? Like, maybe that is the approach and that will beat out these LLM, because they, we'll see what the usage is. They were talking about, they think they will use the least amount of AI credits, like LLM credits, of any team. And that is so interesting from the design space. Like, having, if you think about like LLM usage, program analysis usage, like some axes, right? If we're all in the same quadrant, like, that's just so not interesting. And the winners will probably be decided by a lot of randomness in there, but having this diverse spectrum of like, well, we're going super low AI usage and, but like crazy, you know, traditional AI approaches and other people doing this, and like Theory being like, we're going hard on those LLMs, man. And that, I was like, wow, I am excited to see what happens, because I feel like this design space is sufficiently explored. Like, there's enough delta between the systems.
I agree with that. And you know, going back to the first episode of this season where we were talking to Shellfish and we theorized that there's a hypothetical other side of the spectrum that starts from the LLM that might not even need these program analysis techniques. And then Theory came very close to that. And probably All You Need Is Fuzzing Brain is the second closest.
Was shocking, yeah. Based on the name, this is also why talking to people is so important, based on that name. Although I think Andrew mentioned when he introduced them at Quals that they, yes, were the most, they use the most LLM credits,
yes,
but like, I kind of just like, you're like, ah, whatever, maybe it's feeding into fuzzing, like they found some cool way to do that. But no, they submitted like a 200 line Python program that used mostly LLMs to do this stuff.
Quals.
And, yeah, and qualified with $2 million. And like, that is so freaking cool to see that in that design space.
It's, it definitely feels like a phase shift in a very interesting. I mean, obviously it's been a phase shift, and through the one thing that's another commonality, say from the people's perspective, from the teams, is all of the teams. Is this true? Maybe the vast majority said, "Hey, I started out super skeptical of this AI stuff, and now most of our CRS is written by AI." Right?
Yeah, that was super interesting.
Yeah, and I found similar impacts for me. Of course, also it's hard to say what's the AICC and what's AI just. But you know, the final push of the AICC was a turning point for me in terms of vibe coding. Right, where you know, now I have Claude working on stuff 24/7, like just tons of different directions. Because I think because of experience of team members, actually, like you said, this is what I'm doing in terms of, and I'm like, oh, that's a cool workflow, and this spreads too, right? So from that perspective, you know, that's a cool outcome of ASC. I don't think we talked to a single person that said, I started out skeptical and I'm still skeptical. Like,
yeah, I don't think so. I think everyone was, and it makes, you know, I definitely think that there is a lot of skeptic, you know, there are a lot of skeptics out there, as there should be. I think that's natural in technologies, right? You know, blockchain, I think, is definitely one of those ones that I was skeptical of and still do remain skeptical. But I think the idea here that these people all started out as skeptics. The competition itself, remember, for everyone, did not force people to use AI. Like, there's only mention of AI is in the name. It's the AI cyber competition. It's in the rules of how much AI credits you can use. But there's absolutely no requirement that anybody's team use AI. Like, So you think, like, are these people rational actors that are acting in their best interests? I mean, man, if they could get, like, $4 million without using any AI, because that was in their wheelhouse, the program analysis stuff, and that stuff worked, like, because they're skeptical, they ran it, didn't work as well, and they went hard on that and won, that's such a good, like, existence proof. But the fact that these people that were involved in this and had the goal of winning this money realized the usefulness of this and came around as skeptics, you know, me included, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's an awesome effect of these competitions on both proving the technology to the public, but also proving the technology to the participants. And the second one is very important, because the participants are going to go on and build the next generation of these systems, or tutor, mentor the people that will build the next generation of the systems. And I just remember, you know, we added fuzzing to the mechanical fish in the CyberGround Challenge 3 weeks before the qualifying round, something like that. And basically Hackapo ran up and said, have you guys seen this AFL thing? I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? No, you know, we got symbolic execution. We can reason about data. We can solve these equations.
Dog, we're out here blowing up memory, reason about program paths.
Yeah. Who wants to just send a bunch of random shit? Like, you know, it's fuzzing's washed up technology. Who cares? And, you know, he just went rogue, basically implemented, integrated AFL into the qualifying round system, the mechanical fish, and we wouldn't have qualified without that, right? It's just, I think AI is the, LLMs is the equivalent here.
Yeah, exactly. Crazy, man. Yeah, this is going to be super exciting. Okay, so anything else about the teams that struck you? Like, we talked about the variety of the designs. Anything else that...
The variety of sizes is interesting. So Shellfish...
Of the team sizes themselves. Yeah, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and you saw very real constraints that impacted the companies. So I think we heard from Team Atlanta. So Taesu said, yeah, we had Samsung engineers, but they're risking their career because, you know, they're KPIs or something, KT, or whatever, KPTIs.
Oh, man, this shows that you're, yeah, it's actually, I don't know.
I looked up the acronym. It's something.
I know what it is because I've heard it in a key performance key indicator. Performance it's basically indicator, like your quarterly, like what are you, you know, what are your goals for your job and whatever. So tying that directly into there. And of course, I think Tesu was, you know,
of course,
hopefully being a little bit more joking in his aspect but here, then, but it does definitely, it's a stark difference. Let's say like Team Atlanta, we said five like full-time engineers, was that roughly versus
something
like all you need is a fuzzing brain that had 8 to 10 all academics
students,
and
students and so that there's a lot of this flexibility. I think, I mean, we have the most insight into Shellfish. I think if you just count up all the people that cycle through, including interns, including, you know, everyone, I mean, there's probably upwards of 40 people, but that doesn't mean there was 40 people's worth of effort at all times, far from it. And in fact, there's a lot of effort spent getting people up to speed and then getting their replacements up to speed when their internship expires and all this. So there are these challenges on both the academic and the industry. If you, you know, Trail of Bits had not a large team, that like 8 people total, I think, right? Including turnover, something like that.
It was 8 to 10 with turnover.
Very.
And that's another thing that shocked me. You know, it was interesting to remember about companies is like, you know, they're not constant, right? Like there's going to be turnover. But the interesting thing is, of course, I think like, well, that's, you know, they definitely will be hamstrung by that. But then you think, well, no. We had kind of the opposite of turnover, of increase, right? You have people that jump in and they want to contribute a component or be involved and they're great. But like you said, the ramp up speed is something for sure.
Yes. So there's all of these challenges. That was a super interesting thing in terms of the team composition, which, you know, I don't know. My hunch is that the optimal thing is a team full of late stage students that are ready to graduate. So they're at the you know, efficacy level of these professional engineers, but will delay their graduation for the competition. I think if you have that, that's a sweet spot. But obviously this doesn't quite exist. I mean, I think some of our students...
I think there's a key thing there, and that's the dimension we haven't talked about yet of like how, where were they on the research to production level spectrum, right? I think that's something that I've definitely seen with even senior PhD students. Like you and I both had professional software development experience, and mine wasn't a ton, but
same here.
Even a year gives you a different mindset to code and a different perspective that is so hard to get just during your PhD when you're cranking out research stuff. I love that the AICC, what I saw internally in Shellfish, forced the students to get better at this aspect of developing software as part of a group. I don't think you get this kind of, it's so hard to do this in a single research project. I think you guys with Anger had this a lot more because you were building something large and complex over time in addition to the CTC. So you guys were probably very specially prepared for actually building good-ish code while also having the hacker mentality of get it working and get something that works. So I will be super interested in seeing, you know, I don't mean this in a negative way. I'm not rooting for anyone to fail, but some systems will probably crash. And so like it will be interesting from a post-mortem perspective, like when you're doing an engineering incident, you're trying to figure out why, you know, what was the root cause of why this happened. Just like the CGC had several like emergent behavior, right? Where wasn't it one of the systems was putting out a bunch of patches that overloaded another system's ability to process those patches?
Yes.
And so there may be something like somebody will hit some weird engineering constraint where it's like, oh shit, yeah, we definitely could have been hit by that, but it just was something else. So like seeing how the testing strategies of the team and their production level impacted their ability in the competition is super interesting.
So on this note, the testing strategy, this is very interesting. So we had a wide range of kind of readiness levels on that as well. But in some sense, this whole undertaking of all these interviews, it was some combination of exposure therapy and eye opening to me, right? Because you know I said quite a lot complaining. I did quite a lot of complaining about, oh, I really pushed for this testable, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And it's cool that some teams really took this to heart. So I think we had two teams that are like, yeah, testing stability, that was our critical. And yep. I think the kind of two most in that world were 42 Beyond Bug and Trail of Bits, right? They said, this is our fundamental thing, is everything needs to always work, always be tested. But everyone still suffered at that. I think Trail of Bits mentioned this as well. And everyone said, you know, so much change in the last 3 weeks, right? Despite all of this philosophy, all of this, you know, the last 3 weeks are chaos. And it's easy to be frustrated coming out of the last 3 weeks of chaos and be say, blame, you know, I what did I say? I said we should have everything, you know, tested. But the reality is Shellfish did have it tested. Uh-huh. It was chaos initially. The middle was very well tested, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the end was chaos. But the end was chaos for everybody. And that vantage point is super interesting. Something that didn't exist in the Cyber Grand Challenge because, you know, I was a combination of so in a different role, and there wasn't a podcast like this or whatever. The stories didn't get told like the, you know, oh yeah, we found a bug right at the end.
And that's one of my big regrets, is not having that as a question that we asked all the teams of asking. I think I can't remember which that came up, or if it just came up in the chat, of like, what was the very last bug that you fixed in your CRS before submission, right? That is so fascinating, like you said, to the nature of competition, the nature of software development. Like, yeah, you tested this thing as long as you could, but like, there was still that bug at the end. And of course, what everybody's terrified is about was, what was the end day fix, right? The fix that should have gone in right before, but actually is an end day, did not get fixed in time.
Yeah, exactly. That's the it's easy, the bug you find, but it's, you know, it's the bug you don't hear that gets you.
Exactly.
Or you don't hear the bug that gets you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that, and it's terrifying, right? Because like it was exposure therapy. We were talking to Theory, and I don't remember what Tyler said. He said, you know, we had this bug that did something, 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 and hopefully we fixed it, but who knows? And the whole time I'm thinking, oh God, did we have this bug?
Oh yeah, I got PTSD from talking about, or like the Team Atlanta mega ping across, you know, across the world, like the entire patching team needs to get up because we hard coded this, don't patch anything with the word fuzz in it. And there were challenges with fuzz in it. And
yeah,
that's like, so.
And you know, for us, have you talked, Shellfish mentioned the last bug, right? The timeout that got increased and just melted down the entire CRS 30 minutes before submission. I mean, these are all like these insane things. And in some sense, it's a frustrating situation because it there's no real reason it needs to be this way. For example, one potential router. So I'm thinking like, how do you reduce this strain on the competitors? Because all of this chaos has nothing to do with the goal of the competition. The goal of the competition isn't to see which team is the best at building software.
Mm-hmm,
the goal of the competition is to produce the best software analysis software possible, which involves the former. Someone has to build it for now. But you know, it doesn't. So I think you could do a lot of organizational things, like you say, hey, you get 5 deployments. We will run all 5. We will 5x the competition. We take your best result. So we can take out some randomness, or we average or something. You know. So then, as a team, you have one well-tested version. You release it. You have another one where you release, and then if you fuck up right at the end, you don't cost yourself everything.
But you're just adding more game theory shit in there of like, do you do the crazy ideas that may get you more and increase your variance, but right. reduce yeah. the, this is, yeah, which sucks. And from the flip side, I'd probably say, you know.
Isn't you know, that good? Well, you, then you see the crazy ideas work out.
Maybe. I think that what I'm trying to think about is like, you're coming at it from a very research perspective, which I definitely agree with. But the flip side of that is like the industry perspective where it's like, well, Facebook didn't beat MySpace by submitting broken shit that like crashed all the time, right? Like there's, if you some push code to prod that keeps breaking, like people don't use your stuff. Like what is there that the famous stat about Amazon, like a 50 millisecond slowdown in page loading cost them X million dollars because it cost them in sales, and they have data that shows as you increase page load tide, your sales go down. And so, you know, the companies are out there trying to, and I, the of course, the other side of me is like, yeah, but how good is the software quality in industry anyways? But so in some sense, you kind of, it does make sense. But then again, even the Facebook example is move fast and break things, or it used to be. So their philosophy was just keep pushing changes. If you break it, great, but fix it. But we didn't get a chance. None of the CRSs get a chance to fix it, except for the fact that there were the qualification rounds. But I, you know, the tricky thing, like you said, is yes, there are qualification rounds, but they're so spread out that the deltas between systems is so large.
Well, and there were the exhibition rounds, but there were rule changes after some of the exhibition rounds. So and then, yeah, they figure out, oh shit, okay, yeah. Yeah, but you know, you could see a number of things like you know, the World Series. Okay, I'm about to embarrass myself, but correct me if I'm wrong. I think the World Series people play like 7 games or something, right? The same two teams.
I believe it is 7. I don't know off the top of my head.
But the same two teams play those games.
Yes, baseball and basketball do best of X games in the playoffs, whereas the NFL does not.
Yes. And so you have this like the event, and that's cool because it's the event. And so then you can announce the winners, and then it's not a foregone conclusion or something. But in the same way, you know, between those 7 games, the teams can huddle and say, okay, well, this didn't work. This did work. You know, what maybe we do some more, you know, whatever. And I think that would have led to a winner that had a lot more, that had a much more reliable cyber reasoning system. Because that would have been like, oh, this didn't work. Oh, this worked. So all those exhibition rounds maybe could have been like, you know, we have a couple of like the playoff season. And then here is the thing.
But like you said, with open source systems, this actually is something that somebody could do. Like they can have, you know, they can have these benchmarks that all the systems are running. People could upload new projects with new harnesses and see how the systems do. Like this would be fascinating to kind of do future analysis. Just like I know that
only
you guys
there was a
did.
Large research lab that, you know, had some spare researcher capacity.
Just like CTF Radio is always looking for sponsors, the lab is also looking for sponsors. So
that's right. We'll pause the website, it'll pop up.
Yeah, exactly.
Interested in software analysis? Go talk to.
Hey, would you like to spend some money to sponsor the starving PhD student for
please,
X dollars a day? Please. You can fund exactly. cool. Okay, so let's running kind of long. Let's talk about quickly because we got 8 minutes. You know, this is going to release on Thursday. Winners are announced Friday. So, what are you doing in Vegas? What's the vibe like?
I overloaded my Vegas. First of all, Shellfish is playing in the DEF CON CTF, which 100% no one will be able to focus regardless of what happens on
100%.
Friday morning.
Nobody hacks happy. Nobody hacks sad.
Exactly. This is what happened to us in the Cyber Grand Challenge, right? Like we won $750,000 on Friday morning or Thursday night. And it was no, like basically the only reason we didn't get last place in the actual CTF is that we hooked up the Mechanical Fish and it played the CTF for us, right? Like, it was no one could concentrate. I was just like wandering around Vegas like, holy shit, wow. You know, anyways. So the second thing is we're running DEF CON Academy, as you know, which is an educational effort at DEF CON. So that's going to be crazy. And then the third thing, me and you are going to be running around interviewing people for the DEF CON episode of CTF Radio.
Yep.
Yearly classic this year, except for last year when Shellfish didn't qualify and we didn't go to Vegas. Or no, we did go to Vegas. Oh, we did. Yeah, we did. We interviewed Will and Lucas there.
Yeah,
okay, so this is becoming a tradition. So
Yes. And you have a thing.
Yeah, so I know. I stupidly agreed to write a guest challenge for DEF CON Finals. So I will not even be pretending to be playing CTF with Shellfish. I will be 100%. I don't know about 100%, but I will be helping me make sure my challenge isn't breaking and doing all that. I guess I should say, you know, what Fish would say is assuming that it makes it and I have a challenge on whenever day my challenge would be released. So, yeah, this is a long story. It was something I kind of thought like, man, it'd be cool. Kind of like they got me like one more. I kind of thought I was doing a quals challenge, which I was like, great, this I can kind of crank out, but the baby was born around then, and I was like, there's no way I can do a quals challenge. And so Fish is like, great, then you can do a finals challenge. And I was like, I guess. And I got sucked in. So, but, you know, I love it. Love the community. Hope people like the challenge. We'll also be at, you know, I'll be at the DEF CON Academy space with you. You know, I'll try to pop between. And I think we have some events there. So we should have really cool stuff. So, yeah, find us in Vegas. Say hi.
One sec.
Yep.
I know we're trying to do the outro, but there's two technical things that from the AI Cyber Challenge that I think would be really good to mention.
I'm a fan of Zardes.
Exactly. So one thing is in the AI Cyber Challenge, for those who've listened to the whole thing, people kept saying Serif. It's this static, whatever. It's a static analysis reporting format where the cyber engineering systems were given like, hey, here's the code base, and this might be a bug in it. What do you think? And you're supposed to say yes or no. I didn't see anyone say, hey, we take these serifs and we use it to inform the dynamic analysis part of our CRS or anything like that. Like, the serifs were an afterthought in everyone's submission.
Yeah, I think if they used it at all, it was more like a, hey, we found all these bugs. I think some of the teams did post-processing, as far as I understood, where they essentially ran their system, found everything that it could find, and then went back to the serifs and say, okay, what did we find that was in this? And so the game mechanics that I'm not sure we got into was there were extra points available. The most points you could get was by saying, here's the serif report, it's real, and I have a POV for that's linked to the serif report, meaning it's the same bug, and I have a patch. So all these three are linked. That got you 6 points, which was twice as much as doing a patch. And so basically, like, POV was 1 point, serif was 1 point, the patch was 3, and bundle was 6. But this also decreases over time as well, so with other things. But the point being, like, it definitely makes sense from a usability perspective and future looking of these systems, right? It is cool that if you are able to run static analysis tools that create this serif report or translate, have an LLM translate a GitHub issue or a bug bounty report in, generate the serif report, and then have the system verify it with the patch and the POV, like, that's actually a pretty good win for these systems.
That would be, yeah, I don't think anyone is there.
Yes. So that'll be super interesting to see how that affects the gameplay.
The other thing from a technical perspective that I saw as a commonality to everyone, unless we just didn't get into it with some team and they have a solution, is...
Could be. I mean, these things are super deep. These teams work for 2 hours. I think that was the other thing, is an hour and a half barely felt like scratching the surface for some of these things. Like, we could have talked to them for hours.
Well, absolutely. The other thing was Delta mode. So there are two ways that your targets could be given to you. One is, here's a tarball of the source code. And the other one is, here's a Git repo. And here's the latest commit. And in the former, you have to just find any bugs. In the latter, you have to find bugs that are introduced in that commit.
Which maybe goes into, sorry, I had forgotten that, but this goes into your idea of how future-proof these systems are. Because if this Delta mode is good, then the notion is that you're not testing them on the same software over and over. They are continuously running on every commit that runs.
Yeah. So as a CI, and I think this is critical. So I was not disheartened, but it was interesting to me that their Delta mode wasn't all that anyone used it for was to filter down the preliminary static detections, as far as I could tell. And, you know, to restrict the fuzzer from fuzzing outside of it, stuff like that. There wasn't any, like, we use the truth from the whole thing and we see how it changed. That's an area of research, this sort of differential program analysis, that's not the term. Anyways, it didn't seem that anyone really dug into that, which I think, as you say, could be a critical way that these are deployed, both the Serif case and the Delta mode case.
Yeah, or it could be a way that we just didn't get into it with them, and maybe there is some cool stuff that will emerge when people analyze the open source versions of these.
Yeah, that's possible. And so I think what will be interesting, I mean, we're going to try to track down hunt down the winners and interview them as they're like, ah! But if you can ask them, did that help?
They will be hopefully mobbed by the mainstream media outlets who want to talk to them, but hopefully they'll have
like,
a second.
Excuse me, New York Times. Excuse me.
Hey,
CTF Radio here.
Actually, it's like, you know, I knew that band back when they were playing like backyard shows, right? Like they were, you know, we're the CTF Radio that had them on before they even knew that they won. So,
yeah, that's us. And we have a catchy, you know, well, I guess some of the media has catchy theme songs. Amazing. All right. I think now we had the high level things. I mean, we can talk about this. You know, we've been participating in these competitions, you know, of course, CTS more broadly as well. But like the AICC, the CGC, and these are years of our lives and more specifically of our students' lives this time around. So we could talk about it, like you say, for hours. It's just,
yeah, I think
it's hard to, yeah.
Forward looking. I'm very excited and interested to getting back to some CTF stuff. So I think we'll, going forward, we actually already have, like, unlike previous years where we do DEF CON and then fall asleep for 6 to 12 months. We have people booked for after DEF CON. So we'll have DEF CON stuff. We'll have other people booked. I think we have some cool. I didn't want to break this to you, but you know, you keep saying these season things, but this is only you, I think. It only exists in your mind. There's nothing externally, internally. There's no representation on the videos or the podcasts of which is to which season. So I actually kind of love it. I don't know if I wanted to tell you that. So yeah, maybe the next season.
I mean, you can exactly. You can scroll through. No. Episode D is called season one finale, and episode E is season two premiere.
That is true. I have not done that again since that, though.
Yeah, exactly.
You're good, man.
So, you have at least two seasons. Maybe it's just a really long season two.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say at the bumper at the beginning. But this is our 20th episode.
Hex
20. So pretty good. We're getting up there. Kind of wild. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. You're supposed to stop talking when I say this part. Do you know how this works? Cool. Thanks for joining us today, everyone. I'm Adam D. You can find me online at Adam Dupay. He's Zardis. You can find him online at Zardis. Together, we're CTF Radio. You can find us online at CTF Radio 000, O's not zeros. You can send us questions through email, ctfradio00@gmail.com. And your questions may end up on a future episode of CTF Radio. Take care and happy hacking. This episode of CTF Radio is produced by Adam Dupay. Theme music provided by Swarty. Lyrics by Carlene Dupay.
Algorithms, Easter eggs, it's all about the hack. Python, chaos, nights of sleep never get back. Noob or leak, make your best attack, because it's all for the glory of capturing that flag.
need to know.